you have any questions about the instructions or about your experience, any difficulties you have, at the beginning it's nice to give a forum for that if you'd like. Yes?
I have two questions actually. One is, what happens if a feeling and a physical sensation?
So, I had in mind talk about impermanence today. Impermanence is one of the central teachings of the Buddha. And more importantly than the teachings, it's meant to be one of the central realizations or experiences, insights, that come with Buddhist practice. And most cultures, most philosophies and religions have had some mention, some appreciation of impermanence. Here in the West, we have the famous statement by Heraclitus that you can't step in the same river twice. Buddhism distinguished itself a little bit in being kind of putting impermanence really at the center of much of its way of life or its understanding, its realization. And for having a very thorough analysis of it, very thorough understanding of it, of impermanence. Japanese culture, which has been very much influenced by Buddhism, is impregnated with this notion of impermanence. The Japanese psyche kind of ready to pick it up and see it and moment's notice. The morning dew on a dewdrop on a piece of grass is kind of one of the great symbolic symbols of Japanese culture, because the morning dew will evaporate as soon as the sun comes out. It's there kind of quite temporarily. And there's a famous, probably the most famous piece of classic Japanese literature. It's kind of like the foundation of Japanese literature. It's what everyone kind of, the first thing people memorize or something they read. It's, I don't know what it'd be comparable to like in English, but it's kind of like the, it begins this way. It's called the Hojoki, this text. It was written some 600 years ago. Ceaselessly, the river flows, and yet the water is never the same. While in the still pools, the shifting foam gathers and is gone, never staying for a moment. Even so is the human being and human habitation. So this most famous piece of Japanese literature opens with this pointing towards impermanence. Things are constantly shifting. In the Buddhist tradition, we can distinguish three different levels of understanding impermanence or realizing impermanence. And the first level, we can call perhaps the conventional level of impermanence. The second level, perhaps we can call the vipassana level, that the insight practice, the practice that we do. And the third level is the level of realization. And the first level is often what people will talk about a lot, the conventional level, the obvious level of impermanence, what we can most commonly see in our life, that life changes. And even if we hear a lot of Dharma talks, a lot of the talks often refer to the conventional aspects of change because of the tremendous, you know, that's where we have to cope often. That's where we're kind of negotiating our life, birth, sickness, old age, and death. As people get older, it's quite common for people to develop a greater, if not appreciation, at least a greater sensitivity to that things are constantly changing, not only in their own body, but in their family and friends and people around them. The AIDS epidemic brought home impermanence in a very dramatic way to many people. I remember some years ago teaching on retreat, and a man came on retreat and explained that all his friends had died from AIDS, and he was the last one left of his great circle of friends. And so there's, you know, a lot, you know, in a sense, not to make it trite, or we can call this conventional level, the obvious level of change. And there's a lot of wisdom that can arise from facing and confronting and understanding that level of what's obvious in conventional life. And in a sense, meditation practice helps a lot with this. And meditation practice is helping us develop some constancy in the midst of that kind of change, or some equanimity in the midst of it. Or to quote a recent presidential inaugural speech, we were supposed to make change our friend, which was Clinton's statement when he started his presidency. And meditation practice is one of the ways to find some equanimity, find some peace, find some acceptance of this world of change. As we sit and sit mindfully in the middle of it, of our life, we certainly notice a change of our life. But all things that pass away, all things, new things that arise. But we also notice, more importantly, our relationship to that. Our reactions to that, the ways in which we resist certain kinds of changes, the ways in which we hold on to certain things because we don't want them to go away, the ways in which we are afraid, the ways in which we get angry, the ways in which we get confused, the ways in which we hold on for security. All these kinds of, you know, these are very kind of conventional psychological reactions that people have towards the changing nature of life and how things shift. And as we try to sit and be still and watch the breath and stay present, it's very hard to stay present in the present moment if the mind is fixated on wanting things to be a certain way. As soon as the mind is fixated on wanting to be a certain way, then it kind of the present moment is constantly flowing, constantly changing. And as soon as the mind wants to fixate on something, either through resistance or holding on or whatever, the present moment is going to leave you behind. It's kind of like you go to Heraclitus would go to a river, and rather than stepping into it twice, he would try to take a bucket of water and lift the bucket, fill it with water, and walk around and say, "I have the river here. Look, it's the river in this bucket." And we'd all laugh, right? How silly. The river is, you know, he's kept flowing, and it's not in the bucket of water. Or you take a polarized snapshot of your life, and you go around looking, showing everyone, "This is my life," you know, pointing to that, and not noticing that, you know, life is continuing to change. So there's all kinds of ways in which we get fixated, and part of the basic function of mindfulness practice is to help unfixate the mind so that the impermanent flow of life doesn't leave you behind, or you're not left behind because you're holding on to things. And a lot of psychological insight can come with this level of meditation practice, psychological insight into how we our common patterns of relationship to life. How we, you know, attachment or clinging or fixation takes many different psychological forms. Greed, ambition, fear, insecurity, you know, the whole range of things. And so part of mindfulness practice is to really see all these things, to see them. One famous list is the list of the five hindrances, which can be seen as ways of not being settled on impermanence, kind of the mind fixates on things. And the breath is one of the great ways of learning to be comfortable with this flow of change. The breath, even though it's a kind of impermanent phenomenon, it comes and goes, it has a constancy, it keeps reoccurring over and over again. And it's a fantastic place to settle the mind and develop a constancy of attention. And so the more constant the mind can be on the breath, paradoxically, the more comfortable we can be with change, with the mind can be more, less and less fixated and more fluid with how things go. To have a daily and regular meditation practice that is constant, it becomes a phenomenal aid to helping us see impermanence and be comfortable in it. To sit every day whether you want to or not, to sit every day whether it's a good idea or not, to sit every day whether, you know, whether you can or not, just to sit every day anyway. And so, because then you take it out of the realms of your choice, and you have this constant reference, constant a place where everything else that's changing, shifting and changing, becomes obvious. So having some constancy in your life is very helpful for seeing change. As the mind gets quieter, one of the things we notice in meditation is that when we first sit down to meditate, the mind is like the monkey mind, it's quite busy and active. And that's the last thing, is, you know, everything in the world is relatively constant compared to how the mind is. And then slowly there's a shift in meditation where the mind actually becomes stiller and more constant. And then as it does that, then the impermanence of life around it becomes highlighted and becomes clear. So with time, the mind becomes stiller and quieter in meditation. And then with that, the mind becomes an instrument for seeing impermanence in a clearer way. So this conventional level of seeing impermanence is where a lot of the common wisdom of human culture concerning impermanence arises out of. And as I said, I think you find a lot of people who give Dharma talks will often give examples at the conventional level of impermanence to inspire us to have to a new relationship of understanding. They might talk about, you know, being present for a parent as a parent was dying, and really seeing that level of impermanence and tremendous impact that had on them, and how it changed, you know, very much their relationship to themselves, to life. And it's very transformative to really be able to face and see impermanence at the conventional level. The insight of Vipassana practice goes further than that. Or maybe I shouldn't say further. It's different than that kind of conventional understanding of impermanence, even though it's important. The insight of insight practice is not insight into our psychology. It's not insight into that which is personal in our lives, which we have such a strong bent towards looking at what's personal. You know, what's in it for me, or what's my particular, you know, how does it relate to my story or my biography or my self-concept. And it's, people often think of insight as being, now I understand why I do that. This happened to me 10 years ago, and now this is the way I am, and I finally see, you know, how my psychology works. Those are all important insights. The insight of insight meditation is not the personal insights, but refers to the insights which are universal, which are common to everyone, and not just common to, you know, not just unique to any individual, but that which we all share. And some people, because they have such a very strong personal bent, they're so self-preoccupied, might not at first glance have any appreciation that there's any value in recognizing what is universal. But what is universal, in a sense, is understood to be the underlying basis for the personal. And if you understand the basis for the personal, you have a different relationship to the personal. So the function of insight meditation is to go deeper below the personal into that level of our life which can be said to be, I don't know, impersonal sounds cold maybe, but universal. So, and at this level, we're dropping into what can be called the process level of our life, as opposed to conceptual level of our life. The notion of permanence, to a great degree, belongs to the world of concept, of conceptualization. We have fixed ideas of how things should be. And many of you probably have encountered someone who had a self-image of themselves in a certain way, and they were stuck there in that image. And it's very easy as an outsider to see, oh, you know, you're not that way. You know, you don't have to hold on to that fixed concept of who you are. You're actually constantly changing. Or someone holds you in a fixed idea of you, and you did something once, and, you know, maybe you were generous once upon a time, and now they're always expecting you for a handout from you because they figure that's who you are. They've locked you in. Or once you were angry, and now they're always always afraid of you because they assume that's who you are. It's very easy to kind of then live in these fixed ideas, which are concepts, and miss that actually that people and individuals are constantly changing and flowing. There was a psychological study done some years ago of children, and they gave two sets of children the same test. And I think the test was like multiple choice answers. And the first group of kids, they said, there's one right answer to each of these questions, and you have to find it, and you'll be graded accordingly. And the other group of kids, they said, there's a number of right answers for each question. They're all the same questions, same answers. The second said there were a number of right answers. And so they took the test. And taking the test was not the important part of the experiment. The important part of the experiment was after the test was over, they asked the kids to, I think they had maybe pictures or something, of different kids, some kids who had disabilities, some kids who were normal, kind of whatever that is. And they had to choose from this group of pictures the kids that they would include on some kind of sports team. And the results of the experiment was those kids who had taken the exam where there was one right answer tended to discriminate against the kids who had disabilities when they chose for these teams. And those kids who had been told there's actually several right answers to the same question, they were much more flexible and willing to see maybe people with disabilities had their own strengths and brought something in, and they could also be served on those teams. Isn't that interesting? So we have sometimes fixed ideas of how things are, and they get in the way of, they sort of prejudice us in certain ways. My son, who's three, has few and many, depending on the day or the situation, of these fixed ideas. And some situations are quite fluid for him, like decorating the Christmas tree. I have certain ideas of what Christmas decoration is in a tree, but he understood that you hang nice things from the tree. So he went into the closet and got a clothes hanger. So we now have a clothes hanger from our Christmas tree. That's his contribution to the decoration. You know, I wouldn't have thought that. I live in a fixed world. And he was quite perturbed this morning coming here because he was here and he's outside with someone watching him. And he looked up in the sky and the moon was in the sky. And he was quite upset, or not upset, but he was like, you know, is it going to be evening soon? You know, what's going on here? You know, because the moon for him comes out at night. So we live often in the world of fixed ideas, fixed concepts. And in order to move from the conventional level of understanding impermanence to the unconventional, to the insight level, we have to drop out of the fixed ideas of how things are and begin discerning or seeing clearly how things are actually experienced prior to the ideas we have about them. And that's a big training, to learn to somehow drop out of our thoughts and concepts of ourselves, the world around us, how things should be, and begin seeing how things actually are in the moment-to-moment experience. So, for example, physical pain. When many people react very strongly when they feel physical pain in their body, but the reaction often happens through the filter of their concepts and ideas. How many times have you had a little ache somewhere and you've thought, oh, cancer? You know, I've had that. And then I had it recently, actually. It doesn't happen, you know, in my distant past when I was, you know, before I'd practiced. I mean, it happened recently. And I thought, oh, that's an odd thing to happen, and it must be cancer. So, and then they went to the doctor, and the doctor said, no, it's something else. And because of the contrast of thinking that maybe it was cancer, it was like, oh, great. But if I hadn't had the contrast of thinking it was cancer, I would, oh, it would have been a downer to hear that I had that. But, oh, great. Anyway, so we have these ideas, right? Oh, there's the pain. And so we have this pain, and we have this idea of what it might be. We latch on. And we often then live quite removed, in a sense, from the pain itself. We see it through the filter of our concepts and ideas. It's a fixed thing, the pain. I hate it. This shouldn't be here. We have self-pity, we have embarrassment, we have fear. And we kind of hold it in a sense, at a distance, through all these ideas we have about its meaning, what's going to happen, it's all that. What we train ourselves to do in Vipassana is to drop below this conceptual ideas and to feel the pain directly for what it is, how it actually is experienced. And lo and behold, what you'll find, if the mind can be constant and held there with the pain, is you'll find the pain is shifting all the time. And it's not some fixed idea of pain, but it's made up of different kinds of sensations. It's very interesting sensations. Pulling, tearing, stabbing, twisting, searing, tearing, you know, just a lot of, you know, particular sensations that you can identify. And if you get really close to it and really feel it at the process level of that experience, you'll find that the pain is not even constant. It's not even standing there fixed as a big kind of glob of pain that's unmoving. But if you're really close to it and really feel it directly, you'll find the pain is constantly in flux, like a dance. It might just be in a little square inch of your knee. But in that square inch, you actually find it arises and passes and little moves around a little bit in that space. And there can be a lot of equanimity when you start seeing it as being a dance. is not so constant. It actually arises for a moment, then rises in another place for a moment, even though it's only a millimeter, you know, distance from the first place. It, you know, changes your relationship to it, and there can be a lot of equanimity. You get really close to it, and sometimes it can feel just like vibration, and it can lose its characteristic of being painful, even though it can be quite quite intense. So the same thing with emotions that can happen. And from a distance, our emotions, we can latch onto them or see them as being fixed. Oh, my depression. Oh, you know, often we have strong emotional reactions, sometimes kind of so-called negative emotions. And I think for many of us, there can be kind of almost an unconscious tendency to seeing our emotions as being, oh, this is it. You know, we wake up one morning, we're depressed. It's, oh, you know, we kind of respond as if, oh, I'm going to be depressed forever. This is it. And we forget that sometimes things change a lot. Or we latch onto it. So various ways we take our emotions as being somehow, at least it's fixed for right now, for the day or for the hour. This is the way it is. But if you drop down and actually begin exploring what the actual experience of having that emotion is, if you can drop out of the ideas, the fears, the interpretations, the clinging, the attachments to it, the resistance to it, the assigning of meaning to it that we have, and we drop below that to actually experience it very directly, immediately. How is it experienced? You'll see that the emotion itself is like the pain, is actually in motion quite a bit. Emotion means in motion, moving out. Emotions are in motion. And you find, for example, you get really close to anger. And you find if you really get really close to your anger, you'll see the anger is experienced as certain sensations in the body. And those sensations are in flux or changing. The closer you get, the more you see that it's changing. And then if you see the changing aspect of emotion, if you set it in motion again, then it's a little bit harder to have this, have these conclusions that arise out of some that arise out of the notion that it's permanent. This is the way it is, even if it's permanent for the hour or something. So the insight insight level of impermanence, the second level that we're talking about today, it happens when we can drop out of the conceptual level and start seeing our experience much more in the immediacy of how it actually is being experienced. It's a big training to do that. It's not easy. Again, developing some familiarity and concentration on the breath is very helpful for this, because the breath is a process. The breath is not a concept. And the more you can drop down into the physical experience of breathing, the more you're training your mind not to kind of follow the byways and alleyways or whatever of concepts and ideas, but rather to let go of that and see things more directly. The insight level of impermanence is to start seeing the impermanence of our direct experience. And our direct experience is always changing and impermanent. It's said that the first level of the first time a person really drops down into the insight level of insight meditation, is really drops below the concept and starts seeing things as arising and passing, this level of insight is called tender vipassana. Because your vipassana practice is actually quite tender, vulnerable, or unstable. But tender, I like the word tender vipassana. And tender vipassana level of practice lends itself to a whole bunch of dead ends in practice. And these dead ends are called the ten, have this great name in English, called the ten defilements of insight. Isn't that great? Defilements of insight. You've been trying hard, you know, for, you know, you develop all this insight, and there's defilements to your insight. The list is great. I haven't memorized them so well, but they include things like effort, mindfulness, equanimity, resolution, clarity, light, all kinds of things we kind of think we want, you know, in practice. But all those things, and this tender vipassana, these kinds of experiences can often happen. A lot of light, a lot of joy, a lot of clarity, a lot of really strong dedication in practice, a lot of clarity of wisdom and understanding can occur. And a person can latch onto that, that's it, now I got it. And that attachment and latching on, the fixation on those particular states, is what makes them into defilements. Because it's very important as we move into this level of impermanence, being able to see the arising and passing of things, that we don't latch on to anything. It's not like you finally learned how to swim, and you go in the water, you've been holding on to the side of the swimming pool, and finally you learn you can let go of the swimming pool, the edge of the swimming pool, and then you latch on to the diving board. You know, it's kind of like kind of that way, you know, kind of. Yes. So the tender vipassana. There's a Zen koan. I forget the names of the two Zen monks. And one of them says something like, what should I do when I experience the ceaseless arising and passing of things? And the other monk responds, whose arising and passing is it? So he's not telling him what he should do. He's kind of asking him to look deeper and saying, who's experiencing that arising passing? Or the Zen master Dogen, who said, when the 10,000 things arise and pass all at once, just give up control. Give up control. Give up any notion that there's a self in the midst of that stream, flow of arising and passing. Often, even though when the arising and passing becomes quite pronounced in practice, there can still be some attachment to a fixed person as a reference for that. I'm the one who's experiencing it, and we have to soften that also. That also softens with time. And the function, the purpose of having these universal insights is not to have universal insights. This is often a misunderstanding. People have these great insights, the universal insights of Buddhism, and then congratulate themselves and say, wow, you know, I've got it. This is it. This is so important, you know, and we latch onto that. The purpose of the universal insights in and of themselves are just kind of neutral. They're not of any, maybe in and of themselves, they're not valuable. It's their role in helping us to let go of our clinging, which is important. So the fact that the person's seen this level of practice is not as important as the person allows these insights to massage their clinging, to let go of their clinging. And clinging is really the release of clinging is really at the heart of what the Buddha was teaching. In India, especially at the time of the Buddha, most Indian religions that I know about appreciate impermanence, this phenomenal role of impermanence in life, and are somehow developing their religious philosophies on a foundation of appreciating the impermanent nature of life. Some of the Indian religions, also there was a tremendous appreciation that there's a lot of suffering in life. And perhaps suffering in life was a little bit more obvious back then than it is now. Maybe not for some of us, but some experiences that are sometimes suffering-free today, or relatively suffering-free, were often lethal, deadly in ancient India. I think you know, probably majority of births were, if not painful, many of them were deadly for some of the people involved. So suffering was very obvious. Now, some people in ancient India equated the world of impermanence with the world of suffering. So the very simple equation, suffering, impermanence equals suffering. With that kind of simple equation, the only solution was somehow to get rid of the world of impermanence, to step out of it, to leave it behind, and to find some transcendental level, that either some place where things are permanent bliss, or some place that's totally removed from this world of impermanence. And what that meant, that was a kind of transcendental approach to practice religion, where this world was discounted. This world was not seen as a place where realization could occur. This world was kind of then very easily negated for its value. A renunciation became, for some of these people, renunciation then became very important. They're just going to renounce this world. My understanding of Buddhism is they made the equation differently. So rather than saying impermanence equals suffering, they added one more piece to the equation. And they said impermanence plus clinging equals suffering. And as soon as you add one more piece to the equation, you can kind of take apart the whole equation by just removing that element of clinging. And so the Buddha focused then not on the world of impermanence, but rather our psychological relationship, the attitude we have to that world, as being the place where you can do the spiritual work. So you could be left with a world of impermanence, but you can be free of suffering by no longer clinging. And the insight into impermanence at the insight level is to help train us to begin to let go. Because when we start seeing our direct experience as nothing which is fixed and permanent, it doesn't make any sense to hold on to anything, because it's gone. And one of the great, as this experience of impermanence becomes stronger in Vipassana practice, one of the sometimes confusing and kind of sometimes humorous or experiences is we put so much effort in our practice to be in the present moment. Present moment is kind of like the god of Vipassana. And then when your concentration is really strong, you realize actually it's impossible to be in the present moment. You can't get to it. It's already gone by the time you bring your mindfulness there. You're always like one moment behind. And so if you're always one moment behind the present moment, you can't really hold on to the present moment even, or anything in the present moment. And so it can be an experience of kind of going to bring your attention to hold on to something, and by the time you get there, it's gone. It can be very confusing. But in any case, so slowly, kind of, it's a training then in beginning to let go. And it's a slow training. It's a number of kind of classic steps that happens in that kind of letting go. And then finally, there's a third level of impermanence, which is the level of realization, of enlightenment. And this is not involves more than just seeing the impermanent phenomena of life, more than just beginning to loosen the clings we have, but it involves the final letting go of, maybe not final because these things often come back later, but at least for a moment, it's kind of like I don't know what's in the, I'm just making up an example here. I don't know if it's a good one, but you finally made it to the edge of the pool. You're still up on the dry ground, and you put your foot in, and you see, oh, the water is cool and whatever. It's nice, and then you put another foot in, and you say, well, that's now I know what the water is wet, and that's great. And then you put your hand down and you feel, oh, actually the water is constantly flowing by. Maybe it's not a pool, maybe it's a river. And there's little waves, and you feel, oh, it's always impermanent, this is fine. And then you realize, well, now you've really seen the river, and now you're not going to have any fixed idea of what the river is anymore. You've carried this image in your mind for, you've never seen the river before, but you carry this image from this snapshot someone took many years ago, and you've always had this image of the snapshot of what a river was. And so you've carried that with you forever, and you come to the river and you see, well, actually it's not that way anymore. Great. And you begin letting go of your attachment that the river should be look a certain way. And while you're standing there, one of the sandbanks you're standing on slips away, and you just step back anyway. So you realize, oh, wait a minute, the river is constantly changing. And then finally comes a day where you jump in the river. And then the river just, then you become the river. Or you, I don't know if that's the right analogy, but you then participate much more fully in the impermanence of the river. You're not observing it from the outside, but you, in a sense, become part of what flows in the river. And the experience of Nibbana is a kind of jumping in, kind of letting go or falling in. Though we don't want to call it the river, because maybe you don't fall into anything, you just simply fall. or say it another way, it's a letting go of the last clinging we have. So there's no clinging at all. So in Buddhist practice, for all these different levels of impermanence, developing a constancy of practice, a constancy of mind, is really important. We appreciate impermanence, but we're trying to develop the mind to be constant, to build some strength of mind so the mind can hold itself with equanimity in the flow of change, hold itself constant so that no matter what happens, you're willing to keep the mind the present, come back to the present. No matter what happens, we train ourselves to, can we come back to some feeling of some graciousness about what's going on in the present? Can we come back to some feeling of equanimity, perhaps, in our relationship to what's going on? Can we come back to some relationship of some kind of constancy to the present moment? And as we do that, I believe what happens is that the constancy that we discover becomes less and less a doing and more a not doing. So that the mind, when the mind gets really still, very clear, very empty, it's very constant because it's empty, not because we're trying to do something and hold it in a fixed way. So I hope that this talk is an encouragement for you all to develop your constancy. Without constancy, I don't think there's any Buddhism. And the function of constancy is so we can see more clearly and appreciate more clearly so that we can end Clinton's presidency as it began by knowing how important it is to make change our friend. Regardless who's president. So those are my thoughts this morning. Any comments or questions? Please.
I think that I truly like the person that did put all of your photo albums, your boxes, those, and recycling them. Our Kodak moments in a sort of direct conflict with me.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there certainly can be value and joy in having photo albums. You said a truly mindful person would be very attentive that they don't get attached to those pictures. So it's photo albums plus clinging, which is suffering. You don't have to get rid of the photo albums. You just have to get rid of the clinging. Now, what some people will find is that it's sometimes helpful to get rid of the photo albums because they're so addicted to them. So as a temporary measure, they might kind of let go of them so they can kind of get beyond that. And then after some years, they'll come back and start doing photo albums again. But that's a strategy. It's nothing to do about the nature of photo albums. It's just, given what my mind is, it's useful to not be involved in photo albums for a while until I kind of develop a little bit more mental health. Yes?
Your three levels, I have a sense there's generally a free flow between the conventional and the insight, but the realization, the idea of jumping the river or enlightenment, always, if I know, sticks in my crawl a little bit, it's sort of a kind of permanent thing. Do you think there's as much free flow in and out of from the second to the third, and less focus on either being or not?
I don't know quite how to answer that. The probably yes, to all of it. The Once a person has become, jumped into the river, they might get up and leave the river again, but then they always know that it's possible. They always know what it's like to be totally wet from head to toe. They know what it's like to be floating in the river. And so they know that as a possibility. And so that's something which they will carry with them. But they might go back on shore, and they might go back to whatever else they were doing. And maybe they weren't changed so dramatically by that. So many of their old habits are still operating. But they have some sense, they have some physical embodied sense now, oh, there's another possibility. And there's a reference point for something. How powerful that reference point works in a person's life, I think varies a lot from person to person. And I don't know why it varies so much from person to person. It seems some people, it makes very little impact on their lives. And some people, it makes a huge impact on their lives. Now is there a flow back and forth between them? I think that depends a lot on how a person, the impact that kind of experience has on a person. And it seems to be variable from person to person. I've been told by my teachers in Burma that there are some people who have the experience of Nibbana and not really know it. They kind of go and describe something to their teachers, and the teachers say, you know, that's it. And oh, really? That didn't seem like much. And other people, it's like the Big Bang Theory of enlightenment, we're all individual and very different, so it's very important not to have some fixed idea of how it's supposed to be. So I don't know if that was a satisfying answer to your question. Probably not. Yes. The first experience of enlightenment doesn't change a lot of a person's attachments, unfortunately. So not only that, but some people can actually become worse rather than better, because conceit, for example, still operates, and so there's more to be conceited about. And so, some people get more arrogant and stuff, having had some taste of that. So the first experience in and of itself, that often doesn't change a person that radically. Maybe it's useful to remember that when the Buddha defined or described enlightenment or the different stages of enlightenment, he did it negatively by what was absent. And the absence of something can be permanent. Right. I mean, if you lost your arm in an accident, and so you became one armed person, you're not going to get that arm again. That's a permanent phenomenon. The absence of that arm is basically permanent. It doesn't exactly make sense to refer to it as impermanent, because impermanence refers to things that exist. Things which don't exist, doesn't make sense to talk about them as being impermanent. So things which are absent are not impermanent, they're just absent. And certain abstract concepts are also not things. And so, in the abstract, democracy is permanent, it's whatever. In the practice of it, in details of it, in actual life, maybe democracy is a changing phenomenon. So does that respond to your question? And also, the memory of the experience is relatively permanent. I mean, the question is how well do we remember is a big question, but maybe our memory is changeable. But if you go and visit something, if you go to England. If you've never been to England before and you go to England, and then you leave England, the fact that you've been to England is a permanent thing. You know, that's it. You know, no one's going to take that away from you. The world of impermanence is not going to take that away from you. The actual experience of England is changing, because the actual experience only was there when you were there, and then it stopped. But the history of having been there is permanent. Please.
The moment that you realize that the impermanence is there and that you're grasping the claim, what can you do?
If it's possible, it can be helpful just to let go. Sometimes letting go is a great practice, just let go of it, if it's possible. It's not always so easy to let go. The basic practice in mindfulness is not to let go so much as when you find there's clinging there, one of the practices is then to turn your attention very clearly on the clinging. And then we investigate the clinging, really feel and explore that clinging, get to know it. One of the important principles of Vipassana practice is we don't so much go after the ideal as we try to study, bring our attention to what keeps us from the ideal. So if the ideal is not to cling, we don't try then to chase after non-clinging. We try to really understand our clinging really well. And if you're phenomenally familiar with your clinging, if you're a connoisseur of your clinging, you know all the ins and out of it, then you're more likely not to be caught by it, and it's easier to let go of it. So, you know, don't, if you find yourself clinging to something, don't condemn yourself or criticize yourself for being, you know, a bad Buddhist or something. Say, great, there's that clinging. I need to get to know it. I need to study it. Great, there it is. I get to. So that I can become free of it eventually, but let's really get to know it. So I think that I have to stop. Thank you.